first of all, I'd like to introduce James Plested. He is going to be giving the talk this afternoon on John Berger, Ways of Seeing. James is the environment writer for the Red Flag newspaper. He's very proud of that fact. And he's also one of the designers of the newspaper, too. So he has great claim to aesthetic sensibility. So please make him feel welcome. After he's spoken, we will be able to have some discussion, questions, back and forth. So please just keep your comments till then, and then we'll be able to get into it.
I'd actually probably say I'm sub-designer or assistant designer, but I'm proud to be involved in Red Flag, and everyone should subscribe to that. I'm also feeling pretty happy that I finally graduated to the theatre at Marxism with a microphone and everything. It's like bright lights and all that. Very exciting. So John Berger, got to get used to using one of these. And in conclusion, so getting to know the work of John Berger 2 years after his death, I found myself in a state of retrospective mourning. I previously knew of him as a Marxist art critic and host of Ways of Seeing, but I hadn't really read much beyond his main works. And now, after I've read quite a lot of Berger over the last few months, I actually feel a kind of deep sense of loss, of a world in which there's a little bit less humanity, in which we're all, in some barely tangible way, a little more alone. What I found in Berger, and what so many others have found, is an almost magical ability to connect the broadest possible historical and theoretical vision with the smallest details of our sensory lives. He moves effortlessly from the fluttering of leaves on the breeze to philosophical reflections on the relation between light, time, and being, to the degraded condition of humanity in the era of neoliberal globalization, and then back again, all without ever losing himself or his reader in jargon. His broader vision was one of a deeply and passionately felt humanism, a belief in the immense potential of humanity and a commitment to fighting for a future in which this potential can be fully and freely explored. He had a visceral hatred of capitalism, the destructiveness of which he saw as extending beyond its obvious impact on the material world of humans and nature, to the spirit that animates that world, and to the expressions of that spirit in our artistic and cultural life. The peak of his fame coincided with the high point of the political radicalization of the 1960s and early 70s. Following that, he retreated geographically and to a degree politically, spending the most of the remaining 4 decades of his life living in a small village in the French Alps, and he wrote a series of novels about the life of the peasants in that area. He was, like so many people who lived through the heady days of 1968, deeply disillusioned when the radicalization subsided and the new era of neoliberalism set in. Unlike so much of the intelligentsia of that period, however, he was never much taken by the ideas of postmodernity. To the end of his life, he maintained a commitment to Marxism as the underlying theory that linked his aesthetic interests with his hatred of capitalism and his desire for human liberation. The topic of this talk is Ways of Seeing. I've interpreted this as referring not just to the television series and subsequent book of that name, but to Berger's broader understanding of art and our way of seeing and interpreting artistic works and the human world of which they are the product. The influence of Ways of Seeing on the broader culture obviously far outstrips anything else Berger did. But to limit myself to this would be to do violence to the depth and scope of his significance as a writer and thinker, whose works, including in addition to art criticism, novels, poetry, photo essays, film scripts and so on, span a period of over 6 decades from the 1940s through to his death in 2017. And to be honest, I'm only going to be able to touch on a small fraction of that work today. Okay, so we'll go to the young Berger now. I love it how there's like a barely perceptible ooh every time a new picture of Berger comes up. All right. So Berger was born in London in 1926. When he was just 6 years old, his parents sent him away to an elite boarding school in Oxford, which he hated, and where apparently he spent most of his time writing poetry and reading radical literature. When he was 16, he ran away and enrolled in art school in London. Berger first established himself as an art critic in the early 1950s. Before that, in the late 1940s, he had a brief spell as a practicing artist, teaching art classes and exhibiting his work at galleries around London. His decision to give up on this and prioritise writing was political. He later explained that, "The reason I stopped painting at the end of the 1940s was what was happening in the world. Above all, the threat of nuclear war. In this context," he said, "painting pictures that, quote, somebody would go hang up on the wall seemed like a trivial indulgence." In 1952, he was taken on by the New Statesman magazine, where he wrote a weekly column on art and culture. And it wasn't long before Berger became known as a controversial figure. Given this was the early years of the Cold War, though, and given Berger's status as an avowed Marxist and at that time a fellow traveller of the Communist Party of Great Britain, this wasn't surprising. In 1989, an interviewer commented that, "You certainly raised hell as a young art critic," to which Berger replied, "Well, it wasn't difficult to raise hell in that polite world." During this period, he's involved in many debates about the merits or otherwise of the new, largely abstract artistic currents that came to dominate the Western art scene. The global centre of these new movements was in the US, where abstract expressionist painters like Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, Willem de Kooning were leading the charge. And that's a Rothko painting that sold for US $45 million in 2014. Included the woman in the scale. It's a big painting. So Berger was far from enamoured with these new trends. What he objected to, above all, was the formalism of these works, their lack of reference to anything external to the world of the work itself. No one objects to poetry being different. Sorry, this is Berger. No one objects to poetry being different from everyday speech, but one does object to a poet using words purely for the sake of their sound and rhythmic pattern. He obviously wasn't a fan of the Dadaist sound poets, but that's a sort of side point. As Berger saw it, the rise of formalism in Western art was a reflection of a deeply nihilistic culture. Western art, he believed, had become unmoored from its traditions, from any belief that art could and should play a social role beyond the narrow spheres of the art world of the elites. There was no shortage of innovation and experimentation, but what was lacking was any broader sense of purpose. "This pettiness," he wrote, "this poverty and thinness of ideas and aims, is the most striking characteristic of the present cultural atmosphere in the West. One has the impression that each artist has desperately searched for some little novelty of his own and then been content to mass-produce it and market it." Now, having a sense of purpose didn't mean, for Berger, turning art into political propaganda. What he's getting at is something deeper. Historically, he thinks, the most significant periods artistically have coincided with moments of change and rupture in society's social fabric. Moments when artists felt themselves and their work to be bound to the fate of society as a whole. In the 1950s, with the world divided between the capitalist West and the Stalinist East, the possibilities for change didn't seem so bright. And it's this, Berger argues, that explains the dearth of what he'd regard as any kind of really great art during this period. And Berger's views on Jackson Pollock, the painter of Blue Poles, provide a typical example. And you can go and see Blue Poles in the National Gallery in Canberra. It's a painting that Gough Whitlam bought for $1.3 million in 1973, and he was actually heavily criticised for that. Today it's estimated to be worth $350 million. So Berger relates an episode where a gallery curator commented to him that Pollock's works were just so meaningful. And his response to this is worth, I think, quoting in full. Berger writes, "These pictures are meaningless, but the way in which they are so is significant. Imagine a man brought up from birth in a white cell that is so that he's never seen anything except the growth of his own body. And then imagine that suddenly he's given some sticks and bright paints. If he were a man with an innate sense of balance and colour harmony, he would then, I think, cover the white walls of his cells as Pollock has painted his canvases. He'd want to express his ideas and feelings about growth, time, energy, death, but he would lack any vocabulary of seen or remembered visual images with which to do so. He'd have nothing more than the gestures he could discover through the act of applying his coloured marks to his white walls. Pollock's paintings, Berger argued, are like pictures painted on the inside of his mind. Lacking any sense of a collective social project, he consciously severed all ties to society and attempted in his art to express the purest individualism. The resulting meaninglessness, Berger thinks, tells us something important about our predicament. Through Pollock's work, he argued, one can see the disintegration of our culture. So this is not how most Western art critics greeted the rise of abstract expressionism in the 1950s. Pollock and his fellow abstract expressionists were almost universally feted in the West, at least. In Soviet Union, totally different story, not going to talk about. New York was declared at this time to have toppled Paris being the centre of the art world. Now, we know now that the popularity of the new American art had been given a helping hand by the CIA. The new American painting exhibition, which toured Europe in 1958 and 59, for example, was at least partly funded by it. The art of Pollock and Co. was seen as a weapon in a cultural war with the Soviets. All the innovation and experimentation was supposed to prove just how much more free and liberated American society was than Stalinist Russia. Now, for those of us who stand in the anti-Stalinist tradition, there's no need to take a side in this fight. It's fine if you prefer Pollock to the kind of socialist realist works that were the staple of art in the Soviet Union during that period. For Berger, who in the early 50s was close to the Communist Party of Great Britain, it wasn't quite so straightforward. At the time, it seems, he did want to defend, on some level, the productions of socialist realism against the seemingly much more aesthetically and philosophically sophisticated works of the Western avant-garde. In short, he argued that the socialist realist aesthetic was a necessary stage for a society that was still in the early stages of its construction. Soviet art needed to be given more time to develop. In the meantime, he argued, one could at least appreciate that the works of Soviet artists, though crude, retained a social element that he saw as lacking in the Western avant-garde. Now, thankfully, for us and people who love Berger, I assume everyone in this room, if not at the beginning of the talk, hopefully by the end, like many communists, Berger made a break with Stalinism in the years following the crushing of the 1956 Hungarian Revolution. And also, thankfully, he managed to actually do that without breaking with Marxism as a framework for understanding art and society. Okay. So the next thing I want to touch on is another great bugbear of Berger's, the degradation of art through its subsumption to the capitalist art market. And I think this is something that we're all pretty familiar with. When you look at the kind of mainstream art world today, it's clear how it's almost exclusively the preserve of the rich. In this world, it's not what the content of the art that matters, but the art's monetary value. Art's role as something that can help shape a better future for humanity has been steadily degraded. The mystique of works of art, which used to be associated with a genuine appreciation of their aesthetic power, is more and more reduced to a sense of the immensity of their dollar value. In place of the fetishism of art as an object of religious or social edification, we have fetishism of art as a luxury commodity. Now, this corrupts the art world on every level, not just in the upper echelons. Works deemed masterpieces, like Pollock's work, sell for hundreds of millions. But it's only a tiny fraction of artists who are ever able to survive from their work. The struggling artist faces a choice. Either tailor their works to the taste of the rich, or consign themselves to poverty and irrelevance and marginalisation within the kind of official art world. And for Berger, all this was already apparent in the 1950s. He referred to the mainstream art world contemptuously as the art racket. He held private art dealers in particular contempt. If you could fuck works of art as well as buy them, he wrote, they would be pimps. But if that were the case, one might assume a kind of love. As it is, they dream of money and honour. He described how the commodification of art has an all-encompassing logic that captures and corrupts the work even of the most gifted artists. Those whose works are deemed worthy of the attention of collectors and galleries see their names reduced to a kind of brand, the value of which is completely detached from their content. Berger sees the predominance of art kind of in the modern period from 1950s onwards, art that's designed to shock and disgust its audience as an attempt to defy this logic of commodification. It's like a last desperate scream of resistance, the conscious production of ugliness as a revenge for the reduction of artworks to status symbols for the rich. It's an attempt, however, that's bound to fail. Berger wrote that, I do not mean it metaphorically when I say that soon a dealer will mount an exhibition of shit and collectors will buy it. Not because the public is gullible or because the art world is crazy, but because the passion to own has become so distorted and exacerbated that it now exists as an absolute need, abstracted from reality. For Berger, this situation, if allowed to continue, would mean the death of art. The unique work of art is doomed, he argued. It cannot escape being a ritual object of property, and its content, if not entirely complacent, cannot help but be an oppressive, because hopeless, attempt to deny this role. Now, you might ask at this point what Berger's views on public institutions, galleries and museums and so on, was. You know, these institutions that, theoretically at least, make art and culture accessible to the masses. And the short answer would be that this is better than nothing. But the reality, as he saw it, is that the existence of public galleries only make art accessible in the most literal sense. Working class people can, and often do, visit public galleries and enjoy art, but their experience of art in this context is inherently limited, completely cut off from the daily reality of their lives. And I just have this. This is from the Louvre in Paris, where people gather to look at the great masterpiece, the Mona Lisa. It's a very authentic experience of art. Maybe we can debate if I'm elitist afterwards. So Berger thought that the rescuing of art as a genuinely public and social practice could only occur by the fostering of a kind of cultural commons. The solution wasn't for more public art galleries and museums, it was to bring out art out of the galleries and onto the streets, to build a society in which art is an integral part of working class life. In the 1950s, Berger supported something like a cultural New Deal. He thought the state should employ artists directly. Young painters, he wrote, would prefer to paint a large mural in a hospital, a concert hall, a school, and be paid an ordinary wage, than sell 10 small pictures to the elite. Ultimately, however, he saw the struggle for a genuinely public and social art as bound up with the struggle for socialism. He wrote that there's an absolute incompatibility between art and private property, or between art and state property, unless the state is a plebeian democracy. Property must be destroyed before imagination can develop any further. And I really love just the cut through. Property must be destroyed before imagination can develop any further. Can't really be clearer than that in your radicalism. Okay. So far we've been mainly looking at things that Berger was against. Now I want to talk some more, or a bit more, about what he was for. And in short, Berger was for realism. Not socialist realism at all, and not also art sort of being realistic in the kind of common understanding of that term. If what he was for was for like realistic art, then it's kind of like, you know, why do we need art? Like, we've got photography. Going to be way more realistic, like every time. Like, realism in that sense is what you're after. Berger's realism is one centered on uncovering the hidden realities behind the surface appearance of things. The world that's immediately given to us in perception is but one very limited aspect of the world, thought of as a totality, incorporating both individual experience and everything that goes to make up the content of that experience. Not just direct sensory perception, but history, society, culture, and so on. As Berger put it, no painting of value is about appearances. It's about a totality of which the visible is no more than a code. On the most basic level, Berger sees art as an activity of revealing. Art is a means of communication, he wrote, but it's an essentially imaginative means. And imagination in art consists in the ability to discover and disclose that which exists. Now again, to be clear, that which exists doesn't equate for Berger with that which is given. That which exists can include things that are as yet undiscovered and are only brought into our human world by the work of art itself. Art, Berger says, is an expression of our sense of the inadequacy of the given, which we are not obliged to accept with gratitude. The imaginative visions of the artist can function to expand the boundaries of our world. They disclose that which exists by, for example, allowing us to see objects in new ways. The most powerful creative works can create new ways of seeing that open up new creative avenues for those working in other fields. I thought of a whole long thing about this, but I had to cut it out. I just think a good example of this is the way that the constructivist art, which flourished in the aftermath of the Russian Revolution in 1917, kind of then flowed into design and architecture and all of that more generally. But there's heaps of other examples you can think of. Okay, so as a Marxist, Berger didn't see art as something that stands outside history and society. What's revealed by art in any particular historical conjuncture is conditioned by the social world in which the artists and their work are situated. Cultural achievements are a byproduct, wrote Berger, the byproduct of people's general aims, interests, and values. You couldn't have been a cubist, a constructivist, or a futurist, for example, in the 18th century. The emergence of these artistic movements was bound up with the transformation of society by capitalism in the 19th century, the advance of science and technology through the Industrial Revolution, and so on. But neither was Berger a mechanical materialist. He criticised those who see art as only a visual ideology of a class. This, he says, eliminates art as a potential mode of freedom, which is how artists and the masses have always treated art when it spoke to their needs. Berger refers back to a question raised but never answered by Marx. If art in the last analysis is a superstructure of an economic base, why does its power to move us endure long after the base has been transformed? Why, for instance, do we still find beauty and enjoyment in looking at ancient Greek sculpture when the world that we inhabit is completely different and so different to theirs? In seeking to answer this question, Berger drew on the work of Marxist art theorist Max Raphael. According to Raphael, great art, though always the product of a specific social context, is able to transcend this context and tap into something universal. This universal, for Raphael, can be summed up as something like human creative potential, our ability to create our own world, to impose our own order on things, and not just be subject to the whims of nature and history. The function of the work of art, Berger argues, is to lead us from the work the process of creation which it contains. This process of creation for Berger, as I'd argue for Marx, is central to what makes us human. The mystery of art, the thing that allows it to reach out beyond its time, its universality, its mystery, is the mystery and depth of human experience and the expression of that experience in creative labour. Okay. So the final aspect of Berger's theory of art I want to touch on is his view of art as inherently social and political. He rejected the idea of art for art's sake, not surprisingly. Neither the artist nor the viewer of art can abstract themselves from social and political realities that they inhabit. You might appreciate a sunset or a spectacular view over the ocean purely aesthetically, although these days with climate change, I think that's impossible, really. But to do the same thing with an artwork, which is the conscious product of a human mind, is to do violence to that work and to degrade it. This doesn't mean that Berger thought artists should strive to make consciously political works, or that art can be judged on political content alone. He railed against the reductionist views on art of some on the revolutionary left, who tended to value art purely in terms of its supposedly radical content. If an artist is painting a chair, Berger wrote, he does not automatically make it a socialist painting by placing a copy of the Daily Worker upon it. Although if you put red flag on a chair, I'd probably... Good art for Berger is art that functions to elevate and empower humanity, to deepen and extend our experience of the world, to enrich our understanding of ourselves and the society of which we're part. Berger associates this with socialist politics because he believes that the commodification of art under capitalism forecloses its potential to do any of these things. Berger saw his work as a critic, at least in part, as one of excavating the liberatory content of art that's otherwise obscured by its subsumption into the world of commodities. I think you can see this very clearly in Ways of Seeing, how Berger's attempting to de-reify art, to rescue it from the hands of the wealthy collectors and dealers, and to return it into the hands of the people. You know, he runs those workshops with people, you know, kids and other people, just, you know, saying what they think about art, you know, and very perceptive things as well, what they're saying. So it should be clear from this how far Berger was from basing his judgments on art on its explicit political content. Nevertheless, the greatest works, as he sees it, do tend to be those that situate themselves within explicitly radical political framework. Art must serve, he argues, for the sake of its own health. No traditional single masterpiece has ever been produced without such a sense of service. It's significant, for example, that Picasso has never surpassed Guernica. The explicit, conscious incursion of politics into art isn't something that Berger generally celebrated, but he did see it as necessary in a world in which the very existence of art is threatened. Stupid people often accuse Marxists of welcoming the intrusion of politics. Well, what did I say? Oh, yeah. It's just funny in itself. Yeah. Stupid people often accuse Marxists of welcoming the intrusion of politics into art, he said. On the contrary, we protest against the intrusion. The intrusion is most marked in times of crisis and great suffering, but it's pointless to deny such times. They must be understood so that they can be ended. Art and humanity will then be freer. All right, so given all of this, what kind of art was John Berger into? The answer, in short, is a lot of it. Marx's maxim, nothing human is alien to me, could equally be applied to Berger. Whether he's looking at a cave painting from tens of thousands of years ago, the religious paintings of the Middle Ages, or the latest works of his contemporaries, his enthusiasm for drawing out the depths and complexity of human experience and creative power manifested in a work of art knows no bounds. I'm only going to have time to cover a small number of the artists that Berger regarded as representing kind of his heights, what he regarded as the heights of achievement in Western art today. In each case, I hope to give you a little taste of how, through his writing, he clears a path to the appreciation of the full intensity, aesthetic, political, and moral of these works. I just want to make a brief note here, though, just about, I guess, the gendered nature of, like, the history of the Western art canon and the fact that Berger, you know, very predominantly wrote, in writing about the history of art, about male artists, which, you know, reflects the kind of gendered nature of the Western art canon generally, which is a reflection of women's oppression, you know, over the centuries and their exclusion from, you know, being able to fully realize themselves in these kind of roles that were seen as traditionally, you know, the realm of men or whatever. And so most of the artists that Berger talks about and the ones that I've chosen are all men, but I think it's important that we recognize that history of oppression so that we can actually, you know, fight for a world where, you know, art is genuinely, you know, an activity for everyone and not just a section of the population that it has been historically. So I just wanted to make that point before I go into looking at a few examples. So the first example I'll talk about is a Spanish artist Francisco Goya, whose work spans the latter half of the 18th century and early 19th century. The defining event of Goya's life was the Peninsular War of 1807 to 1814, when Spain was invaded by the French army of Napoleon. Goya remained in Spain throughout the war and was witness to numerous atrocities. So Goya, and I just don't have time to like really explain the artwork, so you just have to look at them and appreciate them. Goya, as Burgess saw him, was a profoundly humanist painter, alive to the immense potential of humanity, as well as its propensity to evil. In the latter period of his life, during the years of the war and after, his works became increasingly dark, culminating in a series of so-called black paintings of the early 1920s. According to Berger, the unique power of Goya's work is due to the fact that he was so sensuously involved in the terror and horror of the betrayal of reason. It's this sense of the betrayal of reason, a betrayal of the possibility of creating a genuinely humane and ordered society, that Berger thinks makes Goya's work so current for those living in the 20th and 21st century. What makes Goya's protest so desperately relevant for us after Book and World and Hiroshima, Berger argues, is that he knew that when corruption goes far enough, when the human possibilities are denied with sufficient ruthlessness, both ravager and victim are made bestial. All right, you might be relieved to hear that the next artist I want to look at is the French painter Henri Matisse. Matisse's life spanned the early years of modernism right through to the 1950s. And I've selected him partly because his example stands in such stark contrast to that of Goya. There's not much in the way of dark paintings in Matisse. And I'll just give you a bit of a slideshow. Matisse's work for Berger is defined by what he calls his nearly religious feeling towards sensuous life. The world of Matisse's paintings is a world of abundance. Not material abundance as such, but an abundance of life itself. Of sunlight, of flowers, of friendship, of music, and so on. The primary way in which Matisse achieved this effect was through his use of colour. According to Berger, nobody who is not painted can fully appreciate what lies behind Matisse's mastery of colour. It's comparatively easy to achieve a certain unity in a picture, either by allowing one colour to dominate or by muting all the colours. Matisse did neither. He clashed his colours together like cymbals, and the effect was like a lullaby. So the power of Matisse's work, as Berger saw it, lay in its potential to awaken us to the immense possibilities of our sensuous lives. Its message, in short, is beauty is all around us. Enjoy. And in the context of the industrializing, class-divided society in which he lived, this message could be seen as having an inherently radical content. Awakened to the possibilities of life, you can't help be drawn to question a society in which these possibilities are out of reach for the vast majority of people. Okay, the next painter I want to touch on is Fernand Laguerre, another French painter. Berger regarded Laguerre as, alongside Picasso, the greatest painter of his time and the closest thing to a socialist painter in 20th century European art. Laguerre, wrote Berger, saw that the machine had made labour collective, that its discipline had created a new class, that it could offer freedom. He suddenly saw machines as tools in the hands of men, no longer as mere objects in themselves. From that moment, everything he painted ceased to be a celebration of the mechanical industrial world as it is, and became a celebration of the richer human world to which industrialization would eventually lead. Like with Matisse, Laguerre's paintings are a celebration of life, but unlike in Matisse, whose focus is much more on the joys of life amid the beauty of nature, Laguerre managed to convey the distinctively modern view of beauty as centred on the potentialities of humanity working in concert with the forces of modern science and industry. Matisse's vision is, I'd argue, fundamentally backwards-looking and romantic, and Laguerre's, in contrast, looks forward to the possible transformation of society along socialist lines. Okay. I just forgot I don't have any more slides on Picasso, but a talk about Berger wouldn't be complete without talking about Picasso. Because although Laguerre was probably, I think, his favourite artist, that's what I picked up from reading a bunch of Berger, he did rate Picasso as a definitive painter of our time. And on Picasso, he said, "Living through a period of colossal confusion, which so many values, both human and cultural, have disintegrated, Picasso has seized upon the bits, the fragments, the smithereens, and with magnificent defiance and vitality, made something of them to amuse us, shock us, but primarily to demonstrate to us, by the example of his spirit, that within the confusion, out of the debris, new ideas, new values, new ways of looking at the world can and will develop." All right. So before I finish, I want to talk a bit about Berger's views on Cubist art. He wrote quite a lot about the moment of Cubism and so on, and about Picasso as well. For Berger, the brief moment of Cubism, from 1907 to 1914, represented the pinnacle of artistic achievement in Western history to the point that, you know, that he was writing. The starting off point for Cubism, whose main practitioners included, alongside Picasso, Georges Braque and Juan Gris, were the rapid changes in society that were occurring due to the development of new machine technology at the beginning of the 20th century. Importantly for Berger, Cubism was born before the carnage of World War I, at a time when the new technologies were seen in an overwhelming positive light as holding out the potential for a radically new and more free way for humanity to exist in the world. During the first decade of this century, Berger wrote, a transformed world became theoretically possible, and the necessary forces of change could already be recognized as existing. Cubism was the art which reflected the possibility of this transformed world and the confidence it inspired. The development of photography and film, the first cars and airplanes, the construction of the Eiffel Tower and the world's first skyscrapers, the rapid growth of industry, all this functioned to unsettle the old assumptions about our most basic ways of relating to the world. I'm going to go through a few different Cubist works. So the Cubists were the revolutionaries of their field. Cubism, wrote Berger, recreated the syntax of art so that it could accommodate modern experience. The proposition that a work of art is a new object and not simply the expression of its subject. The structuring of a picture to admit the coexistence of different modes of space and time. The inclusion in a work of art of extraneous objects. The dislocation of forms to reveal movement or change. The combining of hitherto separate and distinct media. The diagrammatic use of appearances. These were the revolutionary innovations of Cubism. Berger called Cubism the most modern art and the most philosophically complex that's yet existed. The great achievement of the Cubists, as Berger saw it, was to challenge our fundamental assumptions about the relationship of human consciousness to the world. In place of the standard subject-object duality, the classic Kantian perspective of an isolated, atomized consciousness standing opposed to a world of objects that it accesses more or less accurately by the senses, the Cubists mash the whole thing together in an ever-shifting and changing totality. They really love painting guitars. Mandolin. So the subject of a Cubist painting is just as much the work of perception as what's actually being perceived. By requiring the viewer to participate in the construction of the object of perception, rather than just offering up a world of ready-made objectivity, Cubist art aims to draw our attention to our own role in the construction of the world. Reality, as they saw it, wasn't some fixed, immutable agglomeration of things to which we can only passively relate. Reality is a living totality in which we are, as humans, active participants. In their way of seeing everything as immanent, nothing as fixed, Berger wrote, the Cubists laid out a philosophical primer for the 20th century, expressing desires still unfulfilled that the new student and worker movements seem to be rushing forward to meet. And I think he means the new student and worker movements of the 1960s when he says that. The outbreak of World War I in 1914 put an abrupt end to the moment of Cubism. The industrial scale slaughter of the trenches undermined the faith in the liberatory potential of new technology and industry that Berger saw as at the core of the Cubist project. After the war, he wrote, the Cubists came back to Paris. Yet it was quite impossible for them to find or recreate the spirit and atmosphere of 1910. The future of art, as Berger saw it, begins in that small window of time before World War I in Paris. When eventually a modern tradition of art and teaching is established, he wrote, it is to Cubism that its exponents will return as a starting point. Okay, so to conclude, there's obviously a lot more I could say about Berger. I haven't even touched on much of the sort of background to ways of seeing, like Walter Benjamin, you know, the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction. It's something which people might want to talk about, but as I said at the start, like, if you set out to read all of Berger, you'd need like a year or something. Like, he's just written so much. So I really hope that I've managed to convey something of his passion, his humanity and his perceptiveness as a critic of art and society. I haven't finished. I mean, you can cheer for John Berger. So what's the take-home message? You would have missed the take-home message. Lowering the tone. The main thing, I think, is to reaffirm the value of art as a practice that's central to what makes us human. Berger believed that capitalism was destroying art and that to rescue it required a break with the logic of profit and the market. But he also recognised that art can provide a consolation in dark times and the inspiration to fight for something better. Okay, I'm going to try and get through this without turning off it. We live in a world of suffering in which evil is rampant, he wrote. A world whose events do not confirm our being. A world that has to be resisted. It's in this situation that the ascetic moment offers hope. That we find a crystal or a poppy beautiful means that we are less alone, that we're more deeply inserted into existence than the course of a single life would have lead us to believe. Art and aesthetic experience generally is for Berger an expression of the higher calling of humanity. The promise of art is of an existence in which we're free to fully develop our creative powers and to work with others to build a beautiful world. Through the history of art, along with fields like architecture and design, we gain a sense of what's possible, but it'll only be with the toppling of capitalism and the establishment of a collective socialist economy that art can take its place at the centre of human life, where Berger and myself, and hopefully many others, believed it to belong. And I'll leave it there.